according to his promise. We are looking for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. Therefore, beloved, since you look for these things, be diligent to be found by him in peace, spotless and blameless, and grow in the grace and knowledge of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Our growth comes through the Scriptures. Join me this afternoon. This is day 264 in our Through the Bible reading schedule. Day 264, isn't that great? So that makes the math kind of easy. There's 101 more days to go to day 365. Day 264, we're going to start the book of Esther tonight. Esther, we're going to cover chapters 1 through 4. Tomorrow we'll do, I think it's tomorrow, that we will do 5 through 10. After we do four chapters of Esther, we also need to finish the rest of Ezra chapter 6. We also have to then go back to a verse 6 of chapter 4. I highlighted it the other day, about a week ago. I said, this is a verse that is so far out of chronological sequence, it's something we're going to have to come back to later during the time of King Xerxes. So we'll be reading that today as well. All right, Esther chapter 1. Before we get started, let's take a moment for silent prayer, calling upon our Father in his faithfulness to bless our time of study. Shall we pray? Almighty Father, we come before you today, once again, thankful for grace and truth, rejoicing in your faithfulness to bless our time of study. I thank you for the Through the Bible format, even though we're taking in just tons and tons of material, volume of material is coming in, and yet your Spirit, Father, is ministering your word to each one of us. We thank you for that. We praise you in Jesus Christ's name. Amen. All right, Esther chapter 1. Only two books of the Bible named after a woman, featuring woman characters. Ruth, we had very early in the year, and now we have Esther. And I took a quick Facebook survey the other day about the books we have remaining. Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Zechariah, Haggai, Malachi, and all the girls were telling me their favorite was Esther. And I said, oh, well, I know why. Okay, got it. And only one person selected Zechariah. I thought, well, that's interesting. Anyway, how do you pick favorites? God wrote them all. But in this final portion, as I keep saying, we have maybe the least known part of our Old Testament, and the only exception to that is the book of Esther, because this gets taught in Sunday schools, it gets taught in vacation Bible school, it gets taught in a lot of different ways. So, like I say, let's take a look at it. The drama of Esther begins with the Persian king Ahasuerus and his self-manifested glory. So, verses 1 through 9 here of Esther chapter 1. It took place in the days of Ahasuerus. Just so you're not confused, this is the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days, as King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was at the citadel in Susa, in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his princes in attendance, the army officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of his provinces being in his presence. And he displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days, 180 days. Now, it's not that it has to be a non-stop party, but it was a continuous celebration for half a year. When these days were completed, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days for all the people who were present at the citadel in Susa, from the greatest to the least in the court of the garden of the king's palace. And there were hangings of fine white and violet linen held by cords of fine purple linen on silver rings and marble columns and couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry. Oh, I love that word. It's the Greek word for purple. Marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in the golden vessels of various kinds, and the royal wine was plentiful, according to the king's bounty. So, obviously, it's a huge party, and he's footing the bill, and he's funding all of it. The drinking was done according to the law. There was no compulsion, for so the king had given orders to each official of his household that he should do according to the desires of each person. And so, there you have it. And Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the palace, which belonged to King Ahasuerus. And so we have these two celebrations happening in tandem, or happening in different portions of the facility. The drinking bash that Xerxes is throwing out there. Ahasuerus, by the way, is known in the Greek authors as Xerxes, known to us through the history of the various wars as Xerxes, okay? The Bible calls him Ahasuerus, and that's what we'll stick with as we read through this book. And while he's throwing his drunken bash, Vashti also has a celebration that she is showing, a banquet for the women in the palace. And now it's going to come into conflict because he's going to try to bring her from her own bash to his and the dancing that he expects of her. And that is what sets up the conflict here. So this is what begins the chapter. Ahasuerus is better known by his Greek name of Xerxes. He reigned from 486 to 465 BC. We saw his predecessor was Darius, and now we have Ahasuerus. It's actually worthwhile to learn your Persian history, and Wikipedia's got a good page for that if you don't want to read Olmsted, which can be extremely tedious. But just get yourself an overview of Persian history from Cyrus to the conquest by Alexander. And this Achaemenid Empire is well worth your time. Xerxes' assembly of princes in the third year of his reign is attested in secular history. You can read about it there by Herodotus. The geographic description of 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia is likewise confirmed by secular history. It is confirmed, even when the skeptics tell you it is not. They don't like the numbering. They don't like the number 127, and they take issue with that because of other descriptions in Herodotus. But this actually is validated by the Persian records themselves, so we don't really have an issue with that. Also, the multilingual nature of this empire is interesting. That really got started with the Assyrians, then the Babylonians, now the Persians. It'll be a feature of the Greeks and the Romans as well. With all of these Gentile empires, they're more than kingdoms. They're not just a single kingdom of a people group with their language and their territory. These are actually empires where a plurality of people groups are being absorbed with their languages and with their ethnicities and with their cultures, and they're being subsumed under the greater umbrella of the empire itself. So just start to get used to some of these terms as we encounter them. Queen Vashti's refusal to be displayed before the Persian princes is not explained in this passage. But we will take a look at, you know, some of the plausible understandings for it. If we correctly identify her with the historical queen Amestris, then at this time she is pregnant with Artaxerxes. And I can understand, depending on how far along the pregnancy is, why she might not feel like doing the dance that Xerxes is calling for here. But the details on it are not spelled out for us in the text. We're just left to understand it for what it is. And then the wise men that are counseling the king, we get that also. And just, it's a universal principle of men and women that even thousands of years later still makes sense. So on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, in other words, he's intoxicated and he's been drinking for 7 days, he commanded Mahuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zathar, and Carcass, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus. Now, how big of a harem do you need if the staffing for it requires seven eunuchs? It is curious to me. All right. To bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful. All right, so again, we read into the between the lines and we understand certain things. I think I used the word dance earlier. Well, maybe the word dance isn't here, but there is a display, and it's a display of her beauty. What kind of beauty? There's facial beauty, there's bodily beauty, depending on what it is that's expected to be on display here. Whichever form is intended is not clear, it's not spelled out. This text isn't vulgar in that way, but it is something that she is not in favor of. She actually refuses. So Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command. So not only does she not participate in his request, she doesn't even show up. She stays absent altogether. Refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. Then the king became very angry and his wrath burned within him. And so a drunk king is bad enough, but an angry drunk king, okay? Keeping in mind, he's already been humiliated on the world stage. He's already suffered the incredible defeats, Thermopylae, Marathon. We understand some of the history there in the Persian and Greek wars. This is he's licking his wounds, and for a pagan king, you can understand he may have some some self-esteem issues. And now his wife is turning him down. So, I mean, that's bad enough. How do you measure up to Darius Hystapes? How do you measure up to Cyrus? I mean, when both the kings before you were called the great, okay, and they weren't the only kings. There was Cambyses, and there was, I'm forgetting now. But anyway, he has a lot of pressure because of his predecessors, because of certainly Cyrus and maybe not Cambyses, but Cyrus and Darius, clearly, were amazing kings with conquest to their name, with great victories over Babylon and over Egypt, and just amazing. And so here's Xerxes trying to build on that legacy, and his claim to fame, the feather in his cap, is going to be the Greeks. He's going to take the Persian Empire and cross into Europe, or so he thinks. Okay? And he fails. The Persians fail. The Greeks succeed. And he can't figure out why. Well, it's because Michael and Gabriel are fighting against the Prince of Greece, or with the Prince of Greece, against the Prince of Persia. And in the angelic realm, the tide has already turned. But Xerxes just doesn't know that yet. So, the king said to the wise men who understood the times, for it was the custom of the king to speak before all who knew law and justice. And there were close to him, here's another list of men, Karshina, Shether, Adamatha, Tarshish, Merez, Marcena, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and the Media who had access to the king's presence and sat in the first place in the kingdom. When you have a multi-ethnic, multinational empire such as this, and when it, even at its core, the empire itself is a partnership between Medes and Persians, then you're going to have to balance the politics of that, and some of these tribal chieftains are going to have prince status, and that's what these leaders here have. So they sit in first place in the kingdom. According to law, what is to be done with Vashti, Queen Vashti, because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs? In the presence of the king and the princes, Memucan said, Queen Vashti has wronged not only the king, but also all the princes. This is not just a marriage issue. This is a national issue. This is going to spread. If her rebellion stands, then all of the queens, all of the princesses, all of the noble daughters are going to start to defy the authority of their husbands. Also, all the princes and the peoples who are in the provinces of King Ahasuerus, for the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, causing them to look with contempt on their husbands by saying, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought to his presence, but she did not come. In other words, it sets the precedent, it sets the example. This day the ladies of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's conduct will speak in the same way to all the king's princes, and there will be plenty of contempt and anger. If it pleases the king, and this is their suggestion, and remember, when a decree is issued, it cannot be changed, it cannot be revoked. If it pleases the king, let a royal edict be issued by him. Let it be written in the laws of Persia, Media, so that it cannot be repealed, that Vashti may no longer come into the presence of King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is more worthy than she. And he's got several wives, he's got several concubines, and she is now getting set aside. She's getting isolated. She's going to have a life sentence. She'll be fed and cared for. She'll live in the harem for the rest of her days, but she will never see Ahasuerus again. When the king's edict, which he will make, is heard throughout all his kingdom, great as it is, then all women will give honor to their husbands, great and small. At least that's the theory. Okay? Just put your foot down and be a tyrant, and then other women will learn their lesson, theoretically. So this word pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. And so once it's issued, it cannot be revoked. He sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province according to its script, and to every people according to their language. Notice you have a variety of spoken languages, but even when the languages are quite similar, you might have different scripts. The Aramaic script, for example, as opposed to the Proto-Canaanitic Hebrew script, and other a script is a written alphabet or a written form of a spoken language. all the king's provinces, to each province according to its script, to every people according to their language, that every man should be the master in his own house and the one who speaks in the language of his own people. All right, so this reinforces the patriarchy. This reassures that all of the political dealings within the empire are all going to be on a family basis with the fathers as the heads of the households. It's the fathers that are going to be speaking for their people, representing their people within the clan, within the tribe, within the nation, within the empire. And that's chapter 1. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. He remembered her, but he can't do a thing about it. He can't undo it. He can't revoke it. He can't change it. He can never see her again because he told her that she can never see him again. So the king's attendants who served him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king." Yeah, that's the answer. Okay. When you're depressed, you just need a virgin, okay? Or multiple virgins, as the case may be. We're going to have a talent show. We're going to have a contest. We're going to have a beauty pageant. We're going to have an audition procedure for the new queen. Let the king appoint overseers in all the provinces of the kingdom. Remember, there's 127 of them. How long is this going to take him to work through all those virgins until he finds the one that he is going to make his queen? Over all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather every beautiful young virgin to the citadel of Susa, to the harem, into the custody of Haggai, not the prophet, different spelling, Haggai, the king's eunuch who is in charge of the women, and let their cosmetics be given to them. So the tryout won't happen anytime soon. It's going to take some preparation and some warm-ups. Then let the young lady who pleases the king be queen in place of Vashti. And the matter pleased the king, and he did accordingly. So he signs off on the idea. The proposal is presented before him, and he, just like he said in chapter 1, he says, okay, that sounds good. And he does what his advisors are counseling him to do. You know, at this point, I'm starting to wonder, when did he ever make an independent decision of his own? You know, how did he get married to Vashti in the first place? There's a question. You know, probably arranged by his father. All right. Now, I'm calling this the NQAC. Ahasuerus' advisors recommended a new queen audition contest. And I tried to redo that. I need a better name for that. And I tried for 2 weeks. I struggled. I even asked Robert if he could help me. I said, this is so close. It's NQAC. You know, can we do something besides NQAC? Can we do something? Maybe can we create an acronym that really has quack in it? Maybe a Q-U-A-C-K? I just couldn't do it. So after 2 weeks of trying, I finally surrendered and said, okay, Lord, maybe I'm just being goofy and you want a little bit more reverence on this chapter. Anyway, the beautiful virgin selected from Susa. So worse than Hunger Games, right? We're not just picking a combatant, a victim from every province to come and do battle. They're picking a virgin from every province to come and audition, that is, go to bed with the king so that he either takes them as the queen or moves them on into the harem on a concubine basis. So that's the nature of the thing here. And this is maybe not comfortable for us to talk about or think about or deal with, but it's in the Bible. We have to address it. It is God-breathed and inspired for our instruction. And what we're going to see is even through the unpleasant realities of how ugly this episode is, this is what God used to save his people. Because Israel is headed for a massacre until Esther saves her people. And so, you know, very comparable to Joseph being sold into slavery and Joseph serving Pharaoh and how God used Joseph to provide during the 7 years of famine, God uses Esther to provide during the Persian genocide against Israel. And we'll see that by the time we finish Tuesday night, okay? So, let the young lady who pleases the king be queen in place of Vashti. And the matter pleased the king, and he did accordingly. So, in other words, he's not just going to stick with the wives he already has, the concubines he already has. He's not going to, you know, promote somebody internally. This is a talent search, right? Like a headhunting commercial exercise, corporate exercise, sending out for the most beautiful virgins of the land to come and take part in the tryouts. And, the beautiful virgin selected from Susa to compete in the NQAC was an orphan Jewish girl named Hadassah, a little girl named Grace, okay, Hadassah. And this is verses 5 through 11. Now, there was at the citadel in Susa a Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled with Jeconiah, king of Judah. Now, this pronoun who, the relative pronoun, who is the one that was taken into exile? Was it Mordecai himself? Jair, Shimei, Kish? I believe it was Kish. The Benjamite named Kish was the one who was taken into exile from Jerusalem. Okay? Maybe that was in the 605, maybe it was in the 597, maybe it was in the 586. In one of those deportations, a Benjamite named Kish was taken into captivity, who had a son named Shimei, who had a son named Jair, who had a son named Mordecai. So it's a great-great-grandson of the captive, and he's still there. His dad didn't go back, his grandpa didn't go back, nobody went back from Mordecai's family. Okay. Mordecai is still living in Persia, even though there's a temple being built, there's walls being built, there's returns that are happening. All right. So he'd been taken captive into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled with Jeconiah, with Jeconiah, king of Judah. That's the 597 deportation. Same thing with Ezekiel, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had exiled. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had no father or mother. Now the young lady was beautiful of form and face. Okay, that's a very common phrase. We have it throughout the Old Testament, applied to Bathsheba, applied to Tamar, applied to Abigail, applied to countless other examples. It's applied to Esther here. Beautiful of form and face. That's a cultural issue. We don't typically use that today. We don't talk about women in that way, but it was common. She had an attractive personal appearance in her face and her body. And when her father and mother had died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So he adopts her. She's an orphan. He's the uncle. And now he's raising this virgin. Raised by her uncle Mordecai after her parents' death, she has hidden her racial background all her life, taking the Persian name Esther. Now, it is related to the Babylonian and to the Assyrian. All of these languages have interconnections in different ways, but Ishtar would be a form of this name. Esther is a form of this name, very much well-known and attested in a pagan sense to the Queen of Heaven, to the Ishtar worship and the things there. And it's safer to have a Persian name in Persia than to have a Jewish name, a Hebrew name, to be known as Hadassah, pinpointing your alien nature there. Mordecai was a Benjamite and apparently a eunuch in the Persian court. There's a hot debate. He probably was, okay? Esther found favor in the eyes of the chief eunuch in charge of virgins. That would be Haggai. And her audition goes very well. So let's read this detail. It came about when the command and decree of the king were heard, and many young ladies were gathered into the citadel of Susa, into the custody of Haggai, that Esther was taken to the king's palace, into the custody of Haggai, who was in charge of the women. Now the young lady pleased him and found favor with him. So this is the grace of God giving her favor in the eyes of the eunuch Haggai. She hasn't been face to face with Ahasuerus yet, but this is the hand of God's providence. He's providing for this virgin that she finds favor. There's a soft spot in his heart or whatever it is. Whatever. How does God control the moods and the impulses and the ideas and just the gut reactions of, oh, I like this person, or oh, I don't like this person. And all of the prejudices at a moment's notice where you just have a sense of, okay, this is a sweet girl, or oh, this is a horrible girl. Whatever mechanism does that, it's the sovereignty of God. the sovereignty of God. She comes face to face with this guy who doesn't know her from Adam, but he likes her. It's the grace of God at work. Pleased him and found favor with him, so he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and food, gave her 7 choice maids from the king's palace. I don't think all the other auditioner people received that. I mean, like an inside track here. 7 choice maids from the king's palace, and transferred her and her maids to the best place in the harem. So she immediately has an edge in this talent show, this beauty pageant. And Esther did not make known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had instructed her that she should not make them known. Every day Mordecai walked back and forth in front of the court of the harem. This kind of argues to his eunuch status. Okay, they're not just going to let this Jewish uncle walking around kind of loose in the palace anywhere, right, clearly. Okay, so he himself is likely a eunuch and has a legitimate function in this district, in this part of the capital. Probably not for Ahasuerus, but maybe for one of the other princes of Persia. But he walked back and forth in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and how she fared. Now when the turn of each young lady came, did they draw lots? They drew straws? We don't know. They drew little ping pong balls out of an air bubble lottery machine or whatever they did. Each night, the king got a different virgin sent to his bedroom, and the audition took place. And the turn of each young lady came to go into the king Ahasuerus after the end of her 12 months under the regulation for the women, for the days of their beautification were completed as follows. 6 months with oil of myrrh, 6 months with spices and the cosmetics for women. So it was a full year of preparation just to get ready for this audition night. The young lady would go in to the king in this way. Anything that she desired was given to her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. So whatever lingerie, whatever props, whatever oils, whatever food, whatever wine, whatever, whatever, toys, I mean, who knows? She had her choice of whatever she wanted to take, whatever she thought was going to win the contest. In the evening, she would go in, and in the morning, she would return to the second harem, to the custody of Sheshgaz, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the concubines. She would not again go into the king unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. Most of these women would never see him again. Most of these women would functionally be widows after the first night of relations with the king. If she was lucky, she conceived on that night and she would bear a child that would help provide for her in her older years. But either way, she's going to stay as a concubine in all of her days in this second harem, unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. That's another miracle right there. How does he remember any of their names? I mean, okay. Things I want to know. Now, when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, and we don't know, was she early in this list? Was she later in this list? Was she towards, she had the advantages up front, but it doesn't say that she came earlier in the list. When the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, came to go in to the king, she did not request anything except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women, advised. And this was wisdom on her part. I expect all those other women probably had, theories and ideas, and they were talking and had all these plans. But she didn't listen to those other women. She went to the eunuch and just trusted in his counsel. And whatever he advised, and Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her. Again, it's the grace of God at work. So Esther was taken to the king Ahasuerus, to his royal palace, in the 10th month, which is in the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. So my suspicion is she was pretty low in the list, that even though she found favor with the first eunuch, that by the time her number was drawn at random, Xerxes had already gone through quite a few of the other contestants. All right. So the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And that's all the detail we have. Okay? And we don't know what it was. And it doesn't matter what it was. However it is that she found favor in the eyes of her uncle, favor in the eyes of the eunuch, favor in the eyes of all the other women, the contestants, favor in the eyes of the maids that she had been given. Everywhere she went, she found favor, and especially, most importantly, the king himself. She's brought into him that night, and in the morning, he says, "All right, this is my new queen." Made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his princes and his servants. He also made a holiday for the provinces and gave gifts according to the king's bounty. And so all the remaining virgins were gathered together the second time. Then Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. And Esther had not yet made known her kindred or her people, even as Mordecai had commanded her. For Esther did what Mordecai told her, as she had done when under his care. So, she is now the queen. All of this happens here in these first couple of chapters. All right, Mordecai then discovers a plot against Ahasuerus, and through Esther, saves the king's life. In those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, again, he's probably one of the eunuchs. He definitely has a function there. He's working. He's got some kind of capacity that he's serving in government. Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's officials from those who guarded the door, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. But the plot became known to Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. So however this works, and we don't know the details, this is all we basically know, that he still has access to communicate with her, just evidently walking past the harem, or whatever the case may be. Messages can be conveyed, maybe through servants, intermediaries, whatnot. So when the plot was investigated and found to be so, now you've got a reliable informant. You have a reliable informant with sound information, and it's validated. Found to be so, they were both hanged on the gallows, as it was written in the book of the Chronicles of the king's presence. Hanged on a gallows, literally a tree, literally a stake. And we're going to find the Persians developed a method of execution where they used a tree or they used a sharpened stake. It's not hanging like with a noose like we think of in lynchings or hangings or things of that nature. It's actually a piercing. It is a crucifixion or an impaling, to be impaled on a stake. That's the most likely understanding of these gallows. So it's a sharp pointed stake of whatever height. You throw the person over the top of it. They get impaled through their midsection, and then they just hang there. And they hang there, and gravity keeps pulling them down, and the lower they pull, and the thicker the pole gets at the bottom. By the time you reach the bottom of that pole, you're pretty well split in half, and you're probably dead a couple days prior anyway. Pretty gruesome. I'm glad we got to this after lunch and not right before lunch. That would have been bad. So, chapter 3. I mean, you think, hey, great story. You would like to see after it was investigated, found to be true. You would like to read the rest of this and say Mordecai was rewarded, but Mordecai was not rewarded. Mordecai was passed over. This becomes a test. This becomes a humility test for Mordecai's sake. Why does Mordecai not get rewarded? And why is he okay with that? Why is he just leaving himself in the hands of the Lord? Why is he very faithful, very humble? So rather than reward Mordecai for his service, Ahasuerus promotes Haman, and only to his own. This is the first mention of Haman. We don't know his connection with the others. Some of the terminology is interesting. After these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. Man, do some work on the Agagites. Find the, we have the person of Haman, but then we have the term Agagite. Remember Agag? All right. Advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. So there were seven princes of Persia, but now Haman is being elevated. Haman is being spotlighted. Haman is being highlighted as a true friend of the king and a true man of glory. Maybe that's preparation for him to be a successor, unless, of course, Xerxes produces an heir of his own. Anyway, authority over all the princes who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman. For so the king had commanded concerning him, but Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage. Now this is curious too, and these are the verses you got to look at, particularly if somebody is trying to convince you that Romans 13 means you have to obey every command the king ever gives. That, you know, Mordecai is violating the command to be subject to the governing authorities. We obey God, we obey man. If there's something that man orders us to do that violates the commandments of God, then we have to decide. Are we going to render unto Caesar what is Caesar and render unto God what is God's? Bowing down and worshiping a man, God says, you will have no other gods before me. So Mordecai is neither going to bow down, nor is he going to pay homage. So the king's servants who were in the king's gate said to Mordecai, why are you transgressing the king's command? Now it was when they had spoken daily to him and he would not listen to them that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's reason would stand. For he had told them that he was a Jew. Essentially, he's claiming a religious exemption. He's saying, my faith will not allow me to worship a man. I have to worship the Lord God. And when Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down or paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. And this is really where the twist comes in, because he doesn't realize that Esther, the queen, is the same, not only of the same people group, but literally his niece. Okay, now this is not just Mordecai the Jew, but this is the uncle of the queen. Nobody knows that. So not only does he hate Mordecai personally, but he hates the Jewish people collectively, racially. This is anti-Semitism, of course, satanically motivated. So when it was told to him who the people of Mordecai were, therefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. And so this becomes the goal. In the first month, which is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, Pur, that is the lot, was cast before Haman from day to day. So some of these people that are so superstitious, the Romans were this way too, constantly resorting to divination and soothsayers and wanting to know the will of the gods and just using the roll of the dice for these shattering decisions and things. But they were so fearful in their superstition to the demons that they went with it. So the casting of Pur, the casting of the lot, was cast before Haman from day to day, from month to month, until the 12th month, that is the month Adar. And this is how he makes his decision for when are the Jews going to be exterminated. He can't just act on his temper and order them all killed tomorrow. He's limited by the Persian religion. He's limited by the superstitions here. And it's going to give the Jews time to defend themselves is what it's going to do. And it's going to give Esther time to consult with Mordecai for them to pray about it and to get God's wisdom on this event. So Haman then said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. And they're pests. We don't want them here. Right? Their laws are different from those of all other people, and they do not observe the king's laws. So it is not in the king's interest to let them remain. I mean, we're all for multiculturalism, but these people groups have to do what the king tells them to do. They've got to become Persians in their political outlook. Otherwise, why do we have them in our nation? Why do we have them in our empire? They're a threat to us if we keep a disloyal people group in our midst. If it is pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business to put into the king's treasuries. And this is really how the influence comes in. He's paying the bills and he's bribing the king. And you can imagine, this king has already lost a lot of money on the failed invasions of Greece. He's already pretty well plundered the Persian treasuries, and financially he's in trouble. So this invitation is just too good to pass up. The king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, "The silver is yours, and the people also. Do with them as you please." Now that he's in custody of the signet ring, he can really do anything. He can write whatever decree he wants, seal it with the king's signature there with the signet ring, and then let the laws of the Persians cannot be overturned. He's holding the power right there in his hand. So the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and it was written just as Haman commanded to the king's satraps, to the governors who were of each province, to the princes of each people, each province according to its script, each people according to its language, being written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. These are some very long verses, by the way. The longest verse in the Bible is coming up. Stay tuned. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, women and children, in one day. And what's that day going to be? The 13th of day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to seize their possessions as plunder. What a blessing that this judgment day is so far out on the calendar. A copy of the edict was to be issued as law in every province, was published to all the people so that they should be ready for this day. The couriers went out, impelled by the king's command, while the decree was issued at the citadel in Susa, while the king and Haman went down to drink. The city of Susa was in confusion. My suspicion is Xerxes spent most of his time drunk rather than sober, and from day to day, almost every description we have is pretty well of a drunk Ahasuerus. So that's chapter 3. Rather than reward Mordecai for his service, Ahasuerus promoted Haman to a position of authority, second only to his own. Mordecai's daily refusal to pay homage became a source of anger to Haman. Haman's rage motivated him to murder not only Mordecai, but his entire race. I mean, how evil is that? How vicious is that? Well, again, satanically motivated. Satan has no problem finding people that hate the Jews. All you got to do is find somebody that hates one Jew, and then you can easily turn that into, well, let's just kill them all. Let's just kill them all. Haman followed the Persian soothsaying practice of throwing the Pur. This is why the holiday is called Purim. That's the name of the Jewish holiday is called Purim, and it comes from this Persian word. It comes from this practice. The Jews had a similar practice when they would cast lots, when they would draw straws and would cast lots, or when the high priest would use Urim and Thummim. There were other sanctified methods for determining the will of God that were not pagan practices, but this is clearly the pagan practice of divination in order to determine the fortunate timing for a planned event. In the sovereignty of God, the casting of lots provided for nearly an entire year of warning to the Jews for their coming genocide. And I meant to put it in there, doggone it. Go ahead and pencil into these notes the reference there from the Proverbs when it talks about every die is cast, but every decision is from the Lord. You know what I'm talking about? Proverbs, where is that verse? Bible search, every decision from the Lord. Proverbs 16:33. The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. So when you're rolling dice, when you're drawing straws, when you're casting lots, when things are left totally at random, what's random in the human realm, okay? Laws of probability, chaos theory, what do you want to talk about here today? How about the sovereignty of God? That's 100% guaranteeing every roll of the dice, every flip of the coin, every spin of the roulette reel. The sovereignty of God has total control over this universe. Every decision is from the Lord. So yeah, go ahead and pencil in Proverbs 16:33. That should have been added to those notes. I meant to put that in there. Proverbs 16:23. In the sovereignty of God, the casting of lots provided for nearly an entire year of warning to the Jews of the coming genocide. And that's going to be the key to this rescue. It's going to be the key to the Jews not being executed. The king's edict cannot be changed. We know this. This was a feature in Daniel chapter 6 when Darius was tricked into the whole lion's den thing and Daniel was thrown into the lion's den because the decrees of the Persian kings cannot be changed. Now this gets us to chapter 4. In response to Haman's edict, Mordecai undertook a public ministry of humble repentance. Again, there's a lot to be learned here. I think from Daniel and his friends, from Mordecai, we got a lot of examples. Ezra, Nehemiah, this era of Old Testament history is so interesting for us because the Jews have not had a king since Zedekiah was blinded, right? And really, the Davidic throne that was vacated doesn't go back to Zedekiah, it goes back to Jehoiachin. Whichever way you want to count that, the Jewish people don't have a king on this earth any longer. They're subject to Gentile kings. With a vacated Davidic throne, they are at the mercy, at the whims, whatever you want to call it, they are under the Gentile thumb. From Babylon to Persia to Greece to Rome, waiting for the stone made without hands to come crashing down from heaven. They're waiting for the second advent of Jesus Christ is what they're waiting for. And until that happens, until Jesus Christ is seated on the throne of David in victory over his enemies, until that day, the Jewish people are still going to be struggling under Gentile dominion. So his response is a ministry of humble repentance. Take a look at this. When Mordecai learned all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, went out into the midst of the city, and wailed loudly and bitterly. He went as far as the king's gate, for no one was to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. And this is just a public lamentation, and notice it spreads. In each and every province where the command and decree of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting, weeping, and wailing, and many lay on sackcloth and ashes. And the Persian Empire was at a huge extent. You can start to imagine maybe they were thinking, where can we run? Where can we flee? And even in Jerusalem, where the temple is being built and the walls haven't even started yet. You can imagine how much danger that they were in at this time. Then we get introduced here to Hathach, the queen's eunuch. All right, Esther's maidens and her eunuchs came and told her, and the queen writhed in great anguish. So she learns about the Jewish lamentation. She learns about the sackcloth and ashes. She learns about the public grieving over this unjust law. And what's she going to say about it? She's kept her Jewishness secret this whole time. She writhed in great anguish. Some of the worst torture you'll ever face is the torture you have to face alone because you can't tell anybody you're dealing with it. So she sent garments to clothe Mordecai that he might remove a sackcloth from him, but he did not accept them. Then Esther summoned Hathach from the king's eunuchs, whom the king had appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was. So she needs an agent to go as the go-between. She can't just walk out of the harem and go talk to her uncle. So Hathach went out to Mordecai to the city square in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the exact amount of money that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict which had been issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show Esther and inform her and to order her to go to the king and implore his favor to plead with him for her people. So Mordecai knows what needs to happen. The queen needs to go change the king's mind. Say, well, how is she going to do that when an edict of a Persian king cannot be revoked? Okay, well, even if man, all things are impossible, with God, all things are possible. How does this get solved? If there's no solution in the human realm, what are we supposed to do? Just sit back and do nothing? Or do we stay faithful and do what our hand finds to do? Do we continue to serve in various ways? This is what I think the overall message is going to hit us with. So Hathach came back and related Mordecai's words to Esther. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and ordered him to reply to Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king, to the inner court, who is not summoned, he has but one law, that he shall be put to death, unless the king holds out to him the golden scepter so that he may live. I have not been summoned to come to the king for these 30 days. It's been ages since he's called for her, almost a month. Okay? So they related Esther's words to Mordecai. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther. It's kind of interesting how all this involved back and forth with the eunuchs. All of this was back and forth with servants. They could not speak face to face. And yet, it's as if they were because of the way these words get repeated. All right, now I lost track of some of these details here. Hathach, the queen's eunuch, becomes the go-between. Esther offers clothing, likely sanctuary, to Mordecai, but he refuses. Orders Esther to plead their case before the king. Esther fears the danger of approaching the king uninvited, but Mordecai advises her that she is in danger regardless. And that's where these verses come in. And these verses, I tell you, these are powerful. You can preach these. These are principles of divine guidance that we should be paying attention to. Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews." Think about what you know, and then think about what you imagine. Okay? This is the human tendency to wishful thinking. This is the human tendency to pretend that it's not so bad, or that somehow it won't include you, or that somehow you're going to escape. Do not imagine. Why are you clinging to this hope that it won't touch you? Is there a promise somewhere that God said it won't touch you? "For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place." This is powerful. This is the wisdom of God who organizes our circumstances, who knows every what if, who knows if you don't do his will, there's somebody else that will do it. His plan will not be thwarted because you chicken out and you won't do what it is he has for you to do. Sometimes, we have these thoughts too, and the sense God calls us to witness, calls us to evangelize, and then we start, and then we get nervous, and then we get scared, and then we chicken out, and we don't give the gospel. But we know for a fact that we were supposed to, and we hate ourselves afterwards. We think, man, why did I do that? Why didn't I tell them that? It's so easy. Why did I chicken out? Why, you know? The good news is, as God's plan is not thwarted, it's not your fault, this person's going to die and go to hell, they will get the gospel. God has somebody else ready to go because God knew you were going to chicken out. He had somebody else ready to go. But God holds you accountable because you were the one that was supposed to do it. Again, the language is here. If you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise from another place. God will still rescue his people, but you blew it. Your chance to save them is over. Somebody else will be the deliverer. And you and your father's house will perish. And who knows? I love this. This is a who knows question, which is thrown out there as a hypothetical. But the answer is God knows. And we should consider that this is why God does what he does. Who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this? Who knows? Did you ever stop to ask yourself why you were picked? You ever stop to ask yourself why, of all the virgins in Susa, you were picked for the tryouts? And why, of all the virgins in the tryouts, you were picked to be queen? Remember, the lot is cast into the lap, but every decision is from the Lord. She is queen because of the sovereignty of God. And he has her right where he wants her. The right person at the right time in the right place for the right reasons. This is why you're here. Have you ever thought of that? This is such a powerful verse with respect to divine guidance. So she is in danger of Haman's decree. She is in danger of refusing her work assignment of deliverance. Although God is not mentioned here by name, it is clear that Mordecai's views Esther's royal office as the Lord's provision for this very moment. Who knows whether you have attained royalty for such a time as this? You know, the name of God is not found anywhere in the book of Esther. And that has caused some people to doubt its canonicity and to ask, how was a book like this added to the Hebrew canon? How was a book like this added to our Bibles? The name of God is nowhere in this book. Kind of, sort of. There's a code. You can find Yahweh in a certain place. We'll see it. But not spelled out in direct terms. But this who knows question, you have not attained royalty for such a time as this. I think that's screaming the hand of God behind the scenes. The sovereignty of God at work in the provision of the circumstances. The providence of God is seen with a hindsight looking back. So Esther accepts Mordecai's rebuke and asks for a national 3-day prayer meeting and fast before she approaches the king. This is extraordinary. Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go, assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens also will fast the same way." So every Jew in Susa, fasting and praying for 3 days. Esther and her maidens, fasting and praying for 3 days. "And thus I will go in to the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish." She may be walking into her death. She may be just the next Vashti in a line of deposed Persian queens. But she is going to, contrary to the law, uninvited, on this third day, she's going to walk in. "And if I perish, I perish." See, that's in God's hands too. Again, the name of the Lord isn't in this, but it's understood in every way. So Mordecai went and did just as Esther had commanded him. And so 3 days. Now we'll have to come back on Tuesday to find out. It's not a spoiler alert. You've read the story before. You know, she doesn't die. But it is curious what happens next. So I'll pick up on this Tuesday night. Before we wrap up today, though, let's just grab a couple of other details here. The temple is completed on the 3rd of Adar in the 6th year of King Darius. When you get back to reading Ezra chapter 6, verses 14 through 22, the elders of the Jews were successful in building through the prophesying of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo. They finished building according to the command of God of Israel, the decree of Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes, king of Persia. Notice the kings that are mentioned there. Cyrus, Darius, Artaxerxes. No mention of Ahasuerus, but Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes. This temple was completed on the 3rd day of the month Adar. It was the 6th year of the reign of King Darius. That's before Ahasuerus and before Artaxerxes. And the sons of Israel, the priests, the Levites, the rest of the exiles, celebrated the dedication of this house of God with joy. They offered for the dedication of the temple 100 bulls, 200 rams, all of this. I'm running out of time. Appointed the priests to their divisions, as it is written in the book of Moses. They observed the first Passover with a completed temple. All the joys, all the rejoicing. All right, that gets us through chapter 6. And then a single verse in chapter 4. We passed over it earlier. "In the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, they wrote an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem." Didn't do anything with it. "In the days of Artaxerxes, Bishlam, Medrathah, Tabeel, they wrote a letter." We did read that. We read that earlier today. The letter that they sent to Artaxerxes. Okay. What was it that caused Xerxes from responding to their accusations? We don't know. This is a legal political slander, halting the wall building project. They file a sitna. That's a legal accusation, a sitna. Just think of Satan with an A-H on the end of it, a sitna. A sitna is an accusation, even as Satan is the accuser. There's no recorded response by Ahasuerus to their indictment. He is known in secular history as Xerxes. The king of Persia featured in the book of Esther. Maybe it's her influence. Maybe it's Mordecai's influence that keeps Ahasuerus from responding to this Ezra 4:6 accusation. The fact is, we just don't know. I think probably the accusation came too early because it was sent in the reign of Ahasuerus in the beginning of his reign. So I think that's too early for Esther and Mordecai to have an influence. I think, again, it's just the hand of God's providence. keeping Ahasuerus from stopping their building. All right, we'll come back Tuesday, Lord willing, rapture pending. Father, thank you for this day. Thank you for truth. Thank you for all of the grace, abundant blessings of this day. It's been special in so many different ways. We give you the praise and the glory, Father, in Jesus Christ's name. Amen.